Hey there, and welcome to this week's episode of Lost Origins, your number one radio show for all things ancient mystery, alternative historical theory, and lost civilizations. Check us out online at lost-origins.com and sign up for our free newsletter. We're going to be rolling out contests, merchandise, perks for anyone who signs up for updates, so make sure you get in on that. You can also connect with us on tons of social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Make sure you hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode or an article from Lost Origins. This week's episode is brought to you by Inner Traditions and Baron Company. Inner Traditions has been publishing books on esoteric philosophy, New Age spirituality, and alternative health for well over 40 years. Visit innertraditions.com to learn more about their books and authors and to sign up for catalogs, coupons, and special offers. Some of my all-time favorite books have been published by Inner Traditions and Baron Company, so we highly recommend picking up any one of their books. We promise you will not be disappointed. All right, well, this week's episode is going to be fascinating. Today, we're going to be chatting with binary expert and researcher Joe Luciano. Joe's expertise in binary led to him becoming the primary decoder of the binary code that came out of the Rendlesham Forest incident back in 1980. He's going to be explaining his research, involvement in the project, and his theories right after the break. All right, ladies and gentlemen, and we are back. This week, I am so excited. We have the outstanding privilege of chatting with binary expert and researcher Joe Luciano. I first met Joe at a lecture given by Graham Hancock, and while we're waiting for the event to start, you know, we start chatting about our backgrounds and whatnot, and he shares with me his involvement in the Rendlesham Forest incident, and my mind is just instantly blown, right? I've read tons about the incident. I've watched several documentaries on the topic, and it was so incredible to meet somebody in person who had played a direct role in trying to understand what actually happened in Rendlesham Forest back in 1980. So we've kept in contact and developed a pretty neat relationship with each other, and I am very pleased to welcome Joe to our show today. We're going to have him share with us a little bit about his research, his involvement in the project, and his theories. So, Joe, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, Andrew, it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm so glad we had that synchronistic meeting at the Graham Hancock lecture.
Yeah, It was pretty perfect. I think I'm not one for predestiny, but I'm glad that we chose the seating arrangement that we did. So
yes.
So Joe, you were obviously chosen to be a member of the team that worked to understand what happened with the Rendlesham Forest incident, and for a reason. Before we start talking about the incident itself, why don't you share with us a little bit about your background and how long you've been working in technology?
Okay. I'm a retired computer systems engineer. I've been working with computers professionally and personally for over 50 years. Mm-hmm. I worked in major companies doing computer system software, and when the personal computer came about, I even started a computer store in central New York and ran that for several years, and also sold microcomputers, as they were called at the time, via mail order. Actually, I started the mail order business first and then was approached by a fellow who wanted to open a store, and that was in 1976 is when that all started.
Oh, wow.
So in on the ground floor, but it was fun, but didn't make us an awful lot of money. So
sure. And so is that how you got into binary then?
Prior to starting the business, I had been working in various large companies. Actually, it started in the Air Force, as it turns out. I got a draft notice. Many people may not be aware of that. Way back when, we had a draft where every guy who turned 18 had to eventually do some military service, and you got a notice in the mail saying, hey, report for your physical. And then shortly after that, you say, okay, you've been conscripted to be in the Army. I didn't want to be a conscript, so I decided to – I had gotten my physical notice, and I decided to pick the service I wanted to be in, and I wound up picking the Air Force. And as a result of that, I got myself directly into computers because that's something that had fascinated me all of my life. I've always wanted, even before computers were so out there quite a bit, I was always fascinated with computers. So I got myself into it by taking an aptitude test at basic training. Mm. And so I got my initial professional training in computers in the Air Force station at Griffiths Air Force Base in Rome, New York.
Sure.
That's how I got started with computers. So a large part of that was understanding the binary system, mm-hmm. and how computers work. And then subsequent to that, I worked in commercial companies after I got out of the service. And in about 1995, we wound up having our own – well, no, way before that, late 70s, early 80s, we had our own computer in the house, mm-hmm. Because of the fact that I had gotten into the business myself of selling them.
Right.
We wound up even building our own PCs. In fact, I've got two of them in the house running right now, actually three, that we built. When my son came along, he got interested, and we worked together on it. Right. So I've got an intimate connection and knowledge of computers and such, but I'm now retired and I don't do too much of that.
Sure.
That's basically my background.
Perfect.
And I've enjoyed it and I continue to work with computers all the time.
Very good. So for our listeners who maybe aren't super familiar with the Rendlesham Forest incident, I mean, I know it's everywhere online. There's droves of books that have been written about it. It's been in countless documentaries, Ancient Aliens, for example. And yes. For our listeners who aren't very familiar with the incident, perhaps you could kind of give us a little bit of an explanation as to what happened at the Rendlesham Forest in 1980, and kind of walk us through the chronology of what is now known as the Rendlesham Forest incident.
Okay, sure. First of all, a little bit of background with myself relative to UFOs. I've been fascinated and intrigued by the UFO phenomenon for most of my 71 and a half year life. I've read many books on the UFO subject, saw many TV and video documentaries, mm-hmm. attended many lectures and several conferences where I had the opportunity to meet in person many of the UFO researchers and UFO experiencers as well.
Sure.
I just have a library of books that we've read over the years, and I just want to understand what is this phenomenon all about. I'm having a math and science background, I could classify myself as a skeptic, not a debunker, a skeptic, mm-hmm. in the sense that I want to know the truth, and I'm open to various types of interpretations of what this is all about. I'm convinced that there is some kind of a phenomenon that we don't fully understand, mm-hmm. But there are several hypotheses, and all of them at this point are equally plausible, because there's been no absolute proof one way or the other to justify a particular hypothesis.
Sure.
Of course, there's the aliens from outer space hypothesis. There's the multidimensional beings. There's time travelers. There's all kinds of possibilities, yet we can't seem to pin it down. But I'm convinced that there is a very odd phenomenon that's been going on not only for decades, but probably hundreds and thousands of years.
Sure.
The ancient ones reporting it as allegorical, angels from the sky kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a long fascination for me. I've been wanting to try to figure out what is this all about. That's my scientific nature, wanting to understand the facts and the truth of
sure.
the matter. So I became aware of the Rendlesham Forest incident probably in somewhere in the 90s by watching a TV show. Probably it was Robert Stack and Unsolved Mysteries.
Sure.
And I remember being so struck by that incident for a number of reasons. Number one, I particularly like documentaries and shows that interview the primary witnesses rather than secondary researchers spouting off what their theories are or what they think happened. I like to hear from the actual direct witnesses because now you're getting this, the raw story.
Right.
And so I don't know if it was that particular show, but one of the shows actually had the guys that were involved in the Rendlesham Forest incident and interviewed them. Some of them had their faces blocked out and their identity masked, but there were a couple that were on camera. For example, Sergeant Jim Penniston, Airman First Class John Burroughs, were on the screen, and they told their story. The thing that struck me most after knowing about all the famous UFO cases and abduction cases, etc., the thing that struck me about the Rendlesham Forest incident was the fact that Jim Penniston actually saw a landed craft in the forest and touched it and took notes in a notebook about it as he was examining it, because he was a security police officer.
Right.
So he was his job was investigation and recording the facts. And that's the thing that blew my mind, because no other UFO incident, even abduction incidents, are situations where a person who was not under the control of the other beings, the other entities, actually touched a physical craft. And
right.
I said, wow, that's amazing. And it wasn't until December 2010, when we were watching Ancient Aliens, and they had an episode about the Rendlesham Forest incident, and James Penniston revealed the fact that when he touched the craft, he got a download into his mind, a mental image of zeros and ones, and didn't know what they were, what it meant, and the program was stunned by that and decided to expand their coverage in that episode because of that, and wound up having taken the first five pages from his notebook and getting it decoded by their expert. And Jim was fully expecting it to be gibberish or nothing that made any sense. And as it turned out, it did make sense. So when we were watching that episode, my mind was just blown, and it was, like I said, it was like December 30th, 2010. I couldn't sleep that night saying, wait a minute, that's my field, binary.
Right.
I never knew there was binary involved in this incident that I've been so intrigued by for many, many years. I said, this means something. I got to do something about this. How can, you know, by this time I had already been retired, but, you know, I said, binary is my field. And at that time also, I had made Facebook contact with John Burroughs, who was with Jim at the time.
Right.
And I had personally met him very briefly at a MUFON conference in Denver we had attended in July. And I think I had also, by that time, contacted Jim Penniston, who also had a presence on Facebook, and just, you know, friended him, kind of thing.
Sure.
He didn't know me. I didn't know him personally, but I knew him from all the documentaries I had watched. And so I couldn't sleep. And the next night, the next day, I got online and I started looking at all of the forums that were discussing the fact that he just revealed it was actually the 30-year anniversary that they held a conference at the Woodbridge Town Hall in England, mm-hmm. Near where the incident happened, and that's when he revealed about the binary. And so what I did was read all of these forums and digested everything I could, and said, wow, I could probably be of help here, because somehow I also knew that there were more than five pages in his notebook, and only five had been released to the public and decoded. So I, on New Year's Eve night, I sat up and I wrote this big week-long private message to Jim Peniston to convince him that I should help him out in getting his binary message fully decoded.
Wow.
And I wound up sending it to him on 1-1-11, January 1st, 2011, which has always struck me as being synchronistically meaningful.
Yeah.
Binarily, 1-1-1-1. Anyway, I mean, these are some of the odd things that have happened throughout my experience with this. So he responded, and, you know, he didn't know who I was, didn't know my background, and it took a while for me to convince him that, yeah, I was up and up, and I was a good guy. And sometime towards the end of January, he said, okay, Joe, let's do this. And he wound up sending me, through Linda Moulton Howe, who he was working with at the time, sent me images, actually photographic or scanner images of the notebook pages with the handwritten zeros and ones on them. And he wound up sending me, there were 5 pages, then 8 more, 13 pages altogether. And then ultimately later on, we got 3 more pages for a total of 16 pages out of his notebook, which are now online and available for people to look at.
Sure.
But they're all zeros and ones. So now, while I was waiting for him to decide whether or not to engage me as a research member of his team, I went about and wrote a web-based binary decoder program to make my job easier once I got the full binary. And so I got that working, and by the time I had it working, they sent me the pages. I sat down with my wife, who helped me transcribe them into the computer, 0111 0001, you know how tedious that could be. And then, of course, proofreading it to make sure we got it absolutely correct. And then, of course, there were a few cases where his handwriting was a little bit, you know, questionable. You had to figure out, well, was that supposed to be a 0 or a 1 kind of thing? And a couple of places like that.
Sure.
And we got it all in and got it decoded, and that's how I got involved in it. Again, the incident happened back in 1980 at the twin bases of RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge that were at the time occupied by the U.S. Air Force, and it was the largest tactical fighter wing at the time for NATO support. And they had the A-10 Warthog planes there. And they also had, unbeknownst to the British government and against their agreement, they actually had tactical nuclear weapons and bunkers.
Oh, wow.
And that's there are people that believe that UFOs tend to visit our nuclear facilities or nuclear weapons facilities,
right,
for various reasons. So that may be another reason why this happened.
And I think it's fascinating, too, that, you know, in all the books that I've read or the mentions of the incident or on the documentaries, one of the key variables in this equation was Peniston having touched the craft, right?
Right.
And that's when he absorbs all of this knowledge. And then, you know, obviously skeptics are always going to claim that, how could he remember all of that? And B, you know, he must have had some kind of preconceived understanding or at least a foundation of binary. You know, otherwise, why would he know to write such a detailed sequence? But based on you working directly with Peniston, did you ever think that he had an understanding of what the zeros and ones were, what they meant, or an understanding of binary?
Well, here's my take on that. Yes, there's a lot of controversy about that, and a lot of people have differing opinions. But I have worked directly with Jim Peniston, met him on several occasions. First at the February 2011 IUFOC is the first time I met him person to person. My wife and I sat down with him at breakfast, and it was just the three of us talking. And, you know, we got to begin to know him a little bit as a person. And subsequent to that, as I was working more on the code over a couple of year period, we did a lot of Skype talking, and of course John Burroughs got involved. So we went and visited them, and when John was living in Sedona, Arizona, we got to spend several days with them there, mm-hmm. Kathy and I, and got to know both guys on a personal level, and also working on the project, etc. So my take on it is this. You got to remember, this was back in 1980. In 1980, the personal computer didn't even exist
right.
at that time. Well, it did, but it wasn't very prevalent
right.
in the world. Most people had no clue what a computer was. And to them, if they knew about computers, it was a big mainframe computer that filled up a room with big cabinets and stuff that was just huge and they certainly didn't know the inner workings. Most people had no clue what binary was.
Sure.
It wasn't something, you know, I'm intimately familiar with it because I worked with it all the time, but the average public did not. And especially before personal computers came about, most people had no idea. And after talking with Jim, I don't think he really at that time knew what binary was all about. His statements had been, he had this mental picture in his mind of all these ones and zeros flashing in front of his, you know, mind's eye kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
It made him unable to sleep, and so he was compelled. He for some reason he felt if I wrote them down, it would make me feel better, and my agitation would go away. I'd be able to sleep. So that's what he did. He wrote it in his notebook at home. Because the flashing of the ones and zeros happened. Now, this is all a very kind of incredible story, but in my mind, this is what the man said. I've talked to the man. I've met him. I got a gauge that he's being honest about it, and this is what really happened, as fantastical as it may seem. And once he wrote the zeros and ones down in his notebook, he felt better. But to him, the zeros and ones, it was just gibberish, as he called it.
Right.
He said it couldn't possibly be anything meaningful because he didn't know what it was
right.
at that time. Now he has an understanding of it, but back then he had no clue. He was a young 19, 20-year-old guy that was not technically inclined. He was
right.
a policeman.
Well, and technology's advanced so much since then, too. I mean, I think the fact that this occurred before the era of the internet really lends some weight to the validity of his claim, right? I mean, now anybody, anywhere in the world, can hop online, and they can learn any programming language they want, whether it's HTML,
sure.
CSS, JavaScript, PHP, you name it. There are libraries readily available to anyone because of the convenience of the internet. But like you said, I mean, we're back in 1980, so... I mean, that's not something that the general public is logging on and you know, digging through. So,
exactly.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. So let's talk real quick a little bit about your deciphering efforts, right? How long did it take you to complete your decoding efforts? And during this process, were there any noteworthy challenges that you and your wife encountered?
Absolutely. The code, once I had all 16 pages of his notebook, which is a 3.5 by 5 loose leaf notebook, something that I've also had, so I know what it's like, you know. And there were 16 pages, a total of 1,190 zeros and ones. And that would translate to 148 characters or bytes, as we call them.
Sure.
So having written this web-based program, which, by the way, is available to anybody online if they want to go try it out for themselves, but what I wrote it to do was to just take binary zeros and ones and decode them into using various decoding methods. So the first challenge was to determine what encoding method was used, because there are several encoding methods for taking a series of 8 binary zeros and ones and saying, well, that represents an A or an uppercase A or a lowercase A,
sure.
or B or C or a 0 or 1, etc., each character. And after looking at it all different ways and with all the different main prominent decoding schemes, it was... 8-bit ASCII, which is the American Standard Code for Information Interchange, ASCII,
mm-hmm.
that made the most sense, because when you use that decoding method using my program or any other binary decoding program that uses ASCII, it made intelligent sense. The resulting decoded characters made intelligent sense. They were words and they were numbers, and the words were meaningful. If you try to use, like, for example, EBCDIC, which was IBM's encoding method, stands for Extended Binary Extended binary coded decimal interchange code, EBCDIC. Oh my God. Anyway, if you use that, you'd get absolute gibberish.
Right.
To decode this particular message. So it was definitely 8-bit ASCII. That's another thing that the debunkers try to say. You know, number one, why was the message in binary? Well, they're communicating with this guy. Why in binary? Well, I don't think it was an intended communication. I think this craft that he touched, that he witnessed, was a drone of some kind. Therefore, probably computer controlled, or at least digitally controlled, and the most common language. In fact, every digital device we use, what we're doing right now, is all done in ASCII binary.
Right.
Even the military. I have some friends that work in top secret installations here in Colorado Springs that work with the military satellites, and I asked them. I said, "Is your data transferred in?" ASCII encoding? And he says, absolutely. Of course, it's encrypted, but it still uses 8-bit ASCII. Everything you do, your cell phones, your personal computers, every digital device uses 8-bit ASCII nowadays. It has become the de facto standard. So that's why it was in 8-bit ASCII. The craft was a drone. It was a computer controlled, probably digitally controlled in any event. And therefore, I think what it really spit out was a manifest of what its program was, where it was going to be visiting, because the message turns out to be a series of geographical coordinates, latitudes and longitudes, and a few words interspersed there to make up a message that, in my mind, is documenting what this craft either has done or is about to do in terms of visiting various places on the Earth. And each one of the coordinates represents a fairly significant ancient site of some kind.
Right.
If you want, I could basically read the message to you as it was decoded. Oh, the challenges we had was, of course, it wasn't perfect. There were some areas where it wasn't perfect ASCII binary, and I had to, at first, my take on it, and I have this all documented on my site, binarydecoder.info, www.binarydecoder.info. I have my work, I put it out there for the public so that if anybody wanted to question how I came about decoding it and getting the final message, it's all there, documented in great detail. And then especially in the areas where I call them transmission errors, that is, Jim either did not see the pattern correctly, the zeros and ones, or he wrote it down incorrectly. He is human. He can make mistakes. So there were a few areas, and I document them, where it didn't make sense. The binary didn't make sense. There were a couple of them that said, well, gee, if there was an extra one in there or an extra zero, or this zero was a one, et cetera, vice versa, it generally one-bit errors. I said, well, then it would make more sense, so I can make that assumption.
Sure.
But at first, I tried to just be very literal about it, and I said, okay, now I got to work in these areas that don't make sense. But the message goes something like this, and again, it's documented on my website, binarydecoder.info, the complete message. Exploration of humanity, 666-8100, and then there's a coordinate. I won't bog down with reading all the numbers, but there's a coordinate that represents the location of this mythical island off the west coast of Ireland called High Brazil, mm-hmm. and it's documented in ancient maps, but it has since gone below the sea.
Right.
Then it says continuous for planetary advan, and then I've got three characters that I couldn't interpret. Could be advance or advancement if this character is missing. Fourth coordinate, continuat, UQS. Again, these are areas that had transmission errors. And then there's before, and then there's six other coordinates. And then eyes of your eyes, origin, and then the coordinate for High Brazil is repeated. And then origin year, 8100. So for me, that last line confirmed the fact that 8100 is a year, the 8100 that was mentioned in the first line. Mm-hmm. The locations, the six different coordinates are Caracal, Belize, Sedona, Arizona, the Great Pyramid in the Giza Plateau in Egypt, the Nazca Lines in Peru, Taishan Q in China, which actually turns out to be a very sacred mountain with a temple at the top, and the Porta at the Temple of Apollo in Naxos, Greece, a small island in Greece. And so they're all very significant locations. What does it all mean? We don't know. My theory is that it's some kind of a manifest or kind of like a route map kind of thing. Another thing I forgot. Another challenge with decoding this was the fact that there was no punctuation. There were no spaces. There were no decimal points. So that had to be taken into account and try to figure out, well, how especially with the coordinates, where do the decimal points go? And, right. And that took a while. And then what happened, I think it was somewhere in February, I was introduced to Gary Osborne through Jim and John, because Jim had contacted Gary Osborne, because Jim had had this recurring dream about 23.5 degrees, and he didn't understand what that meant. And he had a friend that said, well, gee, I know somebody who's working on something that relates to 23.5, and that was Gary Osborne. So Jim was put in touch with Gary Osborne, talked to him for a while, and Gary had been working on – Gary is an esoteric researcher and author, and he had discovered that 23.5 degrees, turns out, is the obliquity angle of the Earth's axis. It's the tilt of the Earth, 23.5 degrees. Mm-hmm. Jim had no clue what that was, and Gary explained that to him. And Gary had come up with this finding that this angle was very significant and was represented in many Renaissance paintings, the first of which was by Poussin. And he saw that, like there was a painting of Christ with the cross, and the cross was at a 23.5 degree angle. Wow. There were shepherds with a holding a staff. The staff was at a 23.5 degree angle, and on and on and on and on. All these paintings that had this 23.5 degree angle encoded in the painting, because back then, if anybody saw the Da Vinci Code. They realized that the Renaissance people in the in those times could not have messages that somehow detracted from the church. The church was all powerful,
right?
So they encoded things using geometry in paintings and figurines, and so they weren't direct messages, but they were encoding this knowledge. Some of it may relate to Illuminati, Knights Templar, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, as they got more comfortable with Gary, they introduced Gary to me, and Gary and I worked together, and he actually helped. And we had many, many, many Skype calls and many emails back and forth, and he also helped in determining the coordinates and how to interpret them. And then he found another layer of meaning within the code using the geographic coordinates. And unfortunately, his work has not yet been published. Mm. What happened as a result of all of our work, they wound up contacting Nick Pope, a famous UFO researcher who formerly Ministry of Defense UK employee that has become famous in the UFO world. And they got together, John Burroughs, Jim Peniston, and Nick Pope, and they put out a book in April of 2014 called Encounter in Rendlesham Forest. And in that book, I'm documented as being the official binary decoder for the RFI project.
Wow.
And my full decoding is listed there, and the full binary, the pictures of the of Jim's notebook with the original binary is listed in the book, although they got it out of sequence, and I document that on my website, binarydecoder.info.
Sure.
Because the pages aren't numbered. That's the problem.
Right.
But the pictures of the pages and the notebook are in that book. And since then, that was the hardcover in April 2014, and then I think last year they came out with the paperback.
Okay.
So I work with Gary and continue to work with Gary, and Gary and Jim have announced that they are going to come out with a book in December of 2016 that will document Gary's work, which actually gives meaning to the message in terms of the geographic coordinate.
Sure, sure. So let's circle back then real quick. You mentioned High Brazil, and there's plenty of enigmatic maps from antiquity that display things that people from that era aren't really credited with knowing, right? The Piri Reis map is probably the most well-known, but we also have several other maps that showcase South America, that showcase what's argued to be Antarctica, and that's a rabbit hole in its own right. But High Brazil, having being referenced based on the latitude and longitudinal coordinates, I think is just fascinating because I'm not sure if you know off the top of your head when science or academia basically says that island was submerged. Do you know that date?
No, I'm not a geographer.
Sure.
That's not my field. So if I came across it, I've forgotten it.
Sure.
But no, I don't know when it submerged.
But how fascinating, though. I mean, I'm just trying to wrap my head around all of these ancient sites that are very important, too, right? Mm-hmm. Giza and the Nazca Lines and then the site in China. Mm-hmm. I mean, sites that are so important from an archaeological standpoint, but then also from a humanities story standpoint. And those are also tied into, different theories with regards to the world energy grid. It's just, it's very, very interesting to me that these all keep coming up in these contexts, but yet everybody is just kind of writing it off, right? Like, I feel like this incident as a whole, while yes, there are books and it has been featured in documentaries, I feel like this should be more widespread. Do you have any ideas as to why it's not? Is it just because of the controversy surrounding it? Is it because of the taboo nature of the UFO phenomenon? What are your thoughts on that, Joe?
Well, I have a feeling that all of that plays into it. There are people that totally dismiss the binary as being nonsensical and improbable and made up. But Gary has an interesting position on that, and he says we're aware of all of these controversies, and we took them into account we've worked on this for like 4 years and continue to on and off. It's not as frequent now as it was, but we were working almost every day for almost 4 years on this, and we knew about all the different controversies, and Gary's position, and I tend to agree with it, is it doesn't matter what the origin of the binary code is, because some people say, well, it was a psyops thing that was implanted in his head by the military, and that's where the code came from. And it's all manufactured. Or, like you mentioned, you alluded to earlier, Jim made it up because he knew binary and he wanted to create a bigger story for himself.
Sure.
I don't believe that for a minute. I am open to the possibility that maybe it was a psyops. But Gary's position is this. He says, it doesn't matter what the origin of the code is. When he did his work and connected the dots, as we say, an image emerged from that was very, very significant. And in fact, as he worked with it more, he uncovered even more significance by extrapolating a little bit, mirroring points, et cetera, et cetera. And it all ties into this kind of like the focus of your site, Lost Origins, that it has something to do with ancient knowledge that has been encoded. Either in paintings or monuments, or for example, in Giza, in Nazca lines, et cetera, et cetera. There's encoding there that we don't yet fully understand. It has some meaning. It's got to be very important, but We don't understand it yet. We have lost, somehow there's been a break in the knowledge, as Graham Hancock has pointed out, and we lost that knowledge, and now we're trying to get it back again. And there are a lot of people working on this now, Graham Hancock being one of them, Gary Osborne another. In fact, Gary's working on another book that talks about the encoding of these numbers that relates to, I mean, there are some very mystical, strange things related to the correspondence between the diameter of the Earth and the diameter of the Moon and phi and pi and all these special numbers that we have in math, and they're all encoded in these ancient sites. How can that possibly be?
Right.
The ancients supposedly didn't have this deep mathematical knowledge, but they must have somehow, because they encoded it in their designs and their engineering. Their engineering is far beyond what we really give them credit for. And so there's something here. And, that's why I've been so fascinated most of my life with the UFO phenomena. I still believe there's something there that is meaningful, and I don't know what it is, and I'd like to know what it is before I pass.
Right.
that's my goal, and that's why I got involved in this the way I did. Certainly not making any money from it, that's for sure.
Well, sure, and well said. I mean, there exist tons of us that are trying to figure this out, and
right.
I'm also one of them, you know.
I know.
You talked about, and it was very well said, by the way, but you talked about how, ancient man is not credited with having these high levels of understanding of mathematics or, a greater understanding of how the world works. But you analyze any of these ancient sites, Göbekli Tepe, Angkor Wat, Giza, Nazca, Pumapunku, Teotihuacan. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And it is just blatantly staring us in the face that they did have an understanding of this. I mean, the fact that the processional numbers are worked into the construction of Angkor Wat is just fascinating to me. And so maybe the part of the problem with why the Rendlesham Forest incident has not been as widespread is because there is a stigma that goes with giving credit to our ancestors having been more technologically advanced or savvy than we are now. There's like this acceptance worldwide that we are at the zenith of humanity. And I just think that that's so sad and ignorant, honestly. You know?
Absolutely. I mean, we've come to think that our science is perfect and our science knows everything. But over the past several years, it's been proven that no, that's not the case. We keep making new discoveries that that overturn previous theories and previous truths that we thought were absolute. That's not the case. And I've been feeling that way all along, that there's something more that we don't understand, and that our physics and our science cannot explain everything, and even some of the explanations that they have are still not totally correct. Like even recently, there was the articles about, and I've seen the headlines about, they just discovered gravitational waves. You know,
right.
Like never realized that existed before. So yes, I think there was a knowledge back there with the ancient people that we still haven't totally uncovered, and. You know, unfortunately, with the Rendlesham Forest incident, they don't see this connection because nobody has taken the time like Gary did to analyze these geographic coordinates in a way that unveils another message that reaffirms the ancient knowledge in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't seem to have either want to or have made that connection. Like Gary has done, and unfortunately, I can't give you details of it because his work isn't published yet, and he doesn't want that out. And at some point in time, maybe down the road, he'd be willing to reveal some of it, or maybe even come on your podcast or do a text interview like you did with me.
Yeah,
and I continue, to. Talk with Gary. We haven't done a lot of work together recently, but we're friends and we communicate very often, certainly weekly.
Sure.
And I'll keep tabs on that.
Yeah, we appreciate that. And I also look forward to reading his upcoming release. So Based on your research, Joe, are there any portions of the incident or evidence that hasn't been made public? And if so, do you feel like that should be made public? Is there some important evidence that's kind of been left out?
Well, like I said, I know some things about Gary's work that certainly have not been made public. Mm-hmm. As far as the incident itself, No, there's nothing that I know that has not already been made public about the incident. And there have been various versions. There have been both John and Jim have revealed various things along the years. I have a suspicion that there is more to it that either they don't want to say or they have not yet remembered for whatever reason.
Sure.
Whether it's been a forced amnesia or that kind of thing. I think there may be more to it.
Okay.
But what it is, I have no clue.
So any recommendations then for some of our listeners wanting to learn more about the Rendlesham Forest incident, any books that you would recommend or websites that you would direct them to
sure.
to read up more on this?
Well, of course, there have been several books, two of which are the most prominent and most recent. Of course, you've got The Encounters in Rendlesham Forest by Nick Pope, John Burroughs, and Jim Peniston that tells their story of the first night. Remember, the incident took place over three nights, and there's been some confusion about the dates because Colonel Hall, when he put out his memo that has been made public, got the dates wrong in his memo.
Right.
And that was a real problem that got everybody confused. But let me clarify for everybody. I pinned it down. I know exactly what the dates were, not maybe exactly the times, but the dates. It started happening the night of December 25th, 1980, but it went past midnight. In fact, I think they were in the field at 3 a.m., so that's actually December 26th. So that first night was December 25th into the 26th.
Mm-hmm.
The second night was December 26th into the 27th. And the third night was December 27th into the 28th.
Okay.
For some reason, the second night, there's not an awful lot of information about it. It was a very obscure. And the other thing about this is there were dozens and dozens of witnesses, and mostly all military personnel, security police, law enforcement, military, that went out into Rendlesham Forest to investigate these things on all three nights. The first night was just the three guys. It was Jim Peniston, John Burroughs, and Ed Kabansack. Ed Kabansack was the driver and pretty much laid back. It was Jim and John that went forward into the woods. And then on the second night, it's very unclear and obscure, and there are a lot of people involved there. But then on the third night was various people that we know of and a lot of people that we don't know of. You have Colonel Hall, of course, and his famous audio recording. You have Larry Warren. You have I'm not getting his name. That have been well known, and then there were dozens of other people whose names have not been mentioned or that want to remain private,
mm-hmm.
that type of thing. But if you want to know more details from the original witnesses, the main site and the official site is the Rendlesham Forest Incident.com.
Okay.
The Rendlesham Forest Incident.com, that's the official site. If you're interested primarily in the binary and how the binary was decoded, then my site, which is binarydecoder.info.
Mm-hmm.
And on there, I have some other general things on the main page, but also access to the binary decoder itself and complete details on how I decoded every single bit and byte of the RFI binary message.
Very good. So, Joe, any other projects you have coming up or in the works that our listeners should be informed of?
Well, there is something very interesting. It wasn't an official project, but I came to be aware of a recent incident in June of this year, June of 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And this had to do with an Army military guy and his family driving from Georgia to Colorado Springs, as it turns out, to Fort Carson.
Okay.
In that drive, a very strange incident happened to them, where they witnessed a UFO and stayed overnight in a motel. And he had a very similar experience to Jim Pennison, although there's no indication that he touched anything.
Sure.
He had a transmission of binary code into his mind, and he wrote it all out on the back of the hotel invoice okay. the following morning. And he wrote all these zeros and ones. That was published on the internet. So I said, that's me again. Let me sit down. I didn't have any direct contact with anybody, but I got the picture of that, the back of that page with all the zeros and ones, and I wound up decoding it. And it's very, very interesting. Hmm. It had 1,757 bits, which related to 218 characters or bytes, with 13 excess bits that I couldn't decipher into an actual character. And the message said, continuous protection. Oh, another interesting thing about this particular message compared to the Reynolds from Forest binary code, there were spaces. There was capitalization and lowercase letters, and there was decimal points in the two in the coordinates that were mentioned. And the message says, "Continuous protection of humanity, 49.27N, which I assume would be north, 11.5E, which I assume would mean west, and then there was a period. There's actual punctuation for the sentence. Expose hidden knowledge to all citizens. Advancement." And then the word imperative, but it's actually imperative. So some sort of a error there. Mm-hmm. For planetary survival, so advancement imperative for planetary survival, beware of Orion 1350.3 and Z Reticuli 39.170. Avoid signal messages sent.
Interesting.
Yes. So it has some very similarities to the Rendlesham message in a way, but yet it's different. It's a more precise message. Like I said, there's spaces, there's capitalization in lowercase, there's decimal points, etc. So it was a lot easier to decipher. I did that on my own for my own project. But the other weird thing that connects this so dramatically to Rendlesham Forest, the husband and wife, and they had, I think, two or three children with them at the time. So they're in their car traveling, right? They're in the middle of nowhere at night, and they don't know where they are, et cetera. Anyway, they see this thing, and they sit down, and they draw what they saw. And they draw this disc object. It's got multicolored. But on the bottom half of the disc object, they draw some glyphs. And several of the glyphs are almost identical to the glyphs that Jim Pennison saw on the Rendlesham craft that was etched into this black onyx craft that he saw. So it's very, very similar. So there seems to be some sort of a direct connection there. And it was Linda Moulton Howe on her website, earthfiles.com, that has all of this information because she reported that story because mm-hmm. she talked directly with this fellow who wanted to remain anonymous because he's still in the service and he didn't want to jeopardize his career.
Sure.
But he did give her all of this information and she has published it. And I've been in touch with Linda Moulton Howe, in fact, fairly recently, and have offered my services, although she hasn't yet taken me up on it. But I did work with her originally back in 2011 when we first got the binary code, because at that time,
right,
was working with Jim, but they're no longer working together.
But it's crazy though that we have a recurring incident now, you know, and you know, I can't say that, you know, I'm a skeptic, but I always want to make sure that you know, I'm not just quick to jump on the bandwagon of theory X, Y, and Z. And
sure.
You know, if you find something that's singular, then that's almost easier to write off as coincidental versus if you have multiple instances of something throughout history, well then that becomes a little bit harder to discredit, in my opinion. So that's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. Well, of course there have also been binary messages in crop circles, especially the one in Chilbolton, UK, near a radio telescope, actually. It was encoded in the crop circle. It was actually a binary message.
Wow.
So it's not unheard of that binary is involved. And like I said, binary, and especially ASCII binary, is the preeminent and practically only encoding method for all of our digital devices. So why wouldn't a message be in binary, especially if its origin is some sort of digital device or computer or some advanced scientific instrument or whatever?
Sure.
I'm with you. Yes, I have a lot of thoughts and theories about what it might be, but those are only my opinions, and they don't mean anything. I want to see the facts, and I want to prove something, and that's what I try to do. So I'm not about to say, is Rendlesham code authentic? Is it fake? Did it come from aliens? Did it come from time travelers? I don't know. I really don't know. I'm open to all of those theories, but a single one of them has not yet come out and been the only one based on a proven fact.
Sure.
So we just have to continue to search.
Yeah.
I'm a searcher. I'm looking for the truth. I'm looking for the evidence. And I'm open to all of the evidence that's presented, unlike some of the debunkers that poo-poo any piece of evidence because, you know, what is it? Stanton Friedman has a thing. Don't trouble me with the facts. My mind is already made up.
Right, right.
And he calls those people the noisy negativists,
mm-hmm.
because they're out there strictly to debunk. And some of them are employed by some agency as disinformation people. And so you see all this stuff on the internet, and you have to weigh it all. You don't know what is true and what is false. And it makes it a very difficult thing, unfortunately.
Sure, sure. Well, Joe, that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank you so much for taking the time with chatting with us. Today's conversation was fascinating. I always enjoy talking to you, and I look forward to following these developments and other projects that you have in the works, and hopefully we can get you back on the show once we have more data to present to our listeners. So thank you so much.
Well, if I have a minute for one more thing, I'd like to mention that.
Sure.
I'm not directly involved in it. My wife and I are going as audience members. There's a conference, the Under the Stars Conference 2016, July 30th and 31st, at the UFO Watchtower. Have you ever heard of that?
Mm-hmm.
The UFO Watchtower is near Hooper, Colorado, in the heart of the San Luis Valley. And if people want to find out about that, they can go to www.UFOWatchtowerEvents.com. The main reason we're going is because Travis Walton is going to be there. And we had met him at the 2011 IUFOC conference. And he's, again, a very credible guy. And we're looking forward to meeting and talking with him and hearing his presentation at the Under the Stars conference.
Sure, sure. Awesome. Well, Joe, thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's episode of Lost Origins. Again, make sure you hit that subscribe button so you never miss an article or an episode from your friends at Lost Origins. I'm your host, Andrew, and until next time, continue to question everything.